From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show. It's Tech Tuesday. Later in the broadcast, sizing up the future of internet radio. But first, Extreme Makeover Auto Edition. Millions of Americans know diesel fuel as gasoline's dirty stepbrother, a noisy, smoky, workmanlike alternative to regular gas. But engineers around the globe have been working overtime to clean up diesel's act, and they say the smoother, sexier version is ready for the big dance. The European auto market's already taken notice. Diesel vehicles account for roughly half the new models being sold on the other side of the pond. And American regulators have crafted new policies to make sure diesel's coming out party continues here in the U.S. Joining us in the studio is Margot Ogay, Director of the Office of Transportation and Air Quality at the Environmental Protection Agency. Margot Ogay, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
Most Americans know diesel engines as those noisy, smelly, smoky contraptions that powered cars from the 70s and the 1980s, cars that for the most part have gone the way of the dinosaur, but automakers are priming diesel for a big comeback. What's behind the second coming?
Well, Kojo, if you told me 10 years ago that you could put the word clean next to diesel, I would say you must be nuts. There is no such thing. And the reason for that is that diesel engines pollute 10 times as much of particulate emissions and at least twice of nitrogen oxides. Both these emissions are very harmful to public health and environment. Mm-hmm. So 10 years ago, I wouldn't have never thought that I would be sitting here across to you and I would say clean diesel is here. So what has happened? There are two actions that we have taken, if I may go over those two.
Please
regulatory
do.
Actions. The first action is to remove sulfur from diesel. You have to think back in the 70s, when we removed lead from gasoline fuel, and we were able to introduce catalytic converters in gasoline cars. So today, gasoline cars are very clean. So for diesel, we did something similar. We removed sulfur from diesel fuel. So from 500 parts per million, the diesel fuel that you get now in the on the pump is about less than 10 parts per million.
Significant reduction.
Significant, because sulfur, among other things, poisons catalytic converters. So that's the first step. The second step then was to put requirements that will reduce emissions of nitrogen oxides and particulates over 95%. And that is takes place because now the engine manufacturers can introduce catalytic converters to reduce nitrogen oxides and catalytic converters to reduce particulate emissions. I don't know how many times you find yourself driving, you know, behind a bus or a truck and you see this black smoke.
Oh, yeah, often.
It's pretty real. Well, that is the end. New engines introduced as early as 2007 will have very, very clean emissions. So that's now why you can put clean next to diesel.
In the same sentence,
in
who would have believed it? What goes through your mind when you think of diesel? You can call us at 800-433-8850, 800-433-8850. What questions would you need answered before you would consider buying a new clean diesel car? 800-433-8850, or you can send email to Kojo, K-O-J-O, at WAMU.org. The diesel revolution is well underway in Europe, where diesel now accounts for roughly half of the new models that are being sold every year. Why are diesel cars selling so well on that side of the pond?
Well, there are actually two reasons. The first reason is that after the oil shock that took place in the 70s, the Europeans decided to put taxes for all the fuel, not just diesel, but also gasoline. As you know, if you go to Europe, the oil price is much significantly higher than what it is here.
You pay for your petrol.
You pay for your petrol a lot. But for diesel, there are specific tax credits in Europe to encourage the buyers of diesel cars to purchase a diesel car because it does have better fuel efficiency. A diesel car is anywhere from 25% to 40% better on fuel economy than a gasoline car. So that's pretty significant. Because the way that the diesel is combusted, it's a much more efficient engine. So let me finish for Europe. So that's one of the reasons. Also in Europe, they don't have as stringent environmental requirements as we have in this country. And in this country, half of the population breathes unhealthy air. Mm-hmm. And the diesel engines that were introduced prior to 2007, they were bad actors when it came to the environment. So we like our diesels to emit as little as possible so that it doesn't affect the public health and the environment. Now, the Europeans are also moving forward to have more stringent environmental regulations, and they're following the work that we have done here. So these are the two reasons. Notice stringent environmental controls for diesel engines and tax credits to help introduce more diesel engines in the marketplace.
It's a Tech Tuesday conversation about diesel engines. We're talking with Margot Ogay, Director of the Office of Transportation and Air Quality at the Environmental Protection Agency, and taking your calls at 800-433-8850, or you can send email to kojo@wamu.org. You used to be able to get diesel pretty cheaply, but during the past year, diesel's price has climbed to well over $4 per gallon here. How is this going to affect, in your view, the rollout of clean diesel cars?
Yeah. You know, obviously, we have seen increase in prices for both gasoline and diesel, and you're absolutely right. I think the most recent numbers that I have seen is about 50 cents higher for a gallon of diesel versus a gallon of gasoline. And what is going on right now, the refiners across the country have a specific ratio of gasoline versus diesel. You know, how much of gasoline they can produce versus diesel. And it's a supply-demand. These days we are driving less our cars, our gasoline cars, but the diesel consumption and demand continues to go up because most of our diesel equipment today are trucks and buses, mm-hmm. and the freight, you know, we have to move the freight across the country. Also, there is more diesel demand for in China and India. So it's going to take some time for the refiners to adjust that ratio of gasoline versus diesel, but we expect that that's going to take place. So we hope to see the diesel prices leveling off like gasoline.
It is my understanding that you can now get diesel at only 42% of gasoline stations in the United States. Are there any other cues, in your view, that we should be taking from the European system?
I think the cue that we are taking from the European system is to put incentives in the form of tax credits for vehicles like diesels and hybrids that are more fuel efficient. So they are addressing the two big issues that we're dealing with, many big issues these days, but two big issues that are very important to this country and the planet as a whole is the issue of energy security and climate change. So when you look at diesel engines and hybrid engines that can do better on both issues, you know, to address both energy security and climate change, we as a country need to be thinking about incentives to promote those technologies. And you can get tax credits for both hybrids and diesels. I believe diesels you can get anywhere from $900 for a new VW Jetta clean diesel, mm-hmm. to close to $2,000 for a Mercedes clean diesel this year.
Now we can go to the telephones. Here now is Nigel in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Nigel, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Twofold question. One is, why has America taken so long to get round to clean diesel when Sweden has had low sulfur diesel since 1990? And why is the cost, I mean, it was slightly addressed a while ago, is so much higher when it comes off the cracker way below petroleum? I'm very skeptical on this. Knowing that my brother-in-law's diesel in England does 48 miles to the gallon, driven at 85 to 90 miles an hour, we're just so far behind the times, it's unreal.
Your turn, Margot.
Well, you know, it takes time for regulations to be implemented. Those regulations that I'm talking about clean diesel, passed in 1999, so we're not really that far out away from what happened in Sweden. But we typically give anywhere from 4 to 7 years to companies to make the investments. So here really what we ask was for the whole country, for the whole total diesel pool to go down from, you know, 500 parts per million to less than 10 parts per million. That's a huge, huge task. And at the same time, we're asking all the diesel engine manufacturers, you know, that produce trucks and buses and off-road equipment, construction equipment, agricultural equipment, to do the same. So huge investments. It does take time for those regulations to be in place. And that's what it took, the time that it took.
Nigel, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you. I'm still skeptical.
We will see. We move on to Barbara in Chantilly, Virginia. Barbara, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo. It's great to be back on with you again. Great subject today.
Thank you.
Kojo, I sold Volkswagens for 2 years in the Virginia market, and one of the things that I always noticed was the fact that Volkswagen is the only manufacturer, to my knowledge, that produces an economy car that actually has a diesel engine. They don't produce enough of them, so people would be coming in, people would get on waiting lists, and they were always selling out. They would sell out above the manufacturer's suggested retail price. People would pay a higher percentage on the financing to get them. So basically the cost-benefit analysis of getting a diesel versus a gas car didn't make a lot of fiscal sense because for the simple reason, supply and demand, there is not enough diesels being brought into this country. Ford produces a diesel car for an economy car that they send to Europe, but it's not in the market here. So that's the first issue I'd like to see addressed.
Okay, well, let's address them one at a time. Allow me to have Margot Ogay respond to that.
Okay. Again, what I want to remind your audience is that the diesel regulatory requirements in Europe are different than in this country. Necessarily, you cannot say that the European car that Ford introduces in Europe will meet our environmental requirements. So that's one issue. There are a number of companies that are in the process of introducing clean diesel in the marketplace. And let me just go over at least the companies that we are working with that have received a certificate from the Environmental Protection Agency to introduce these cars in the marketplace for this fall. And it's VW Jetta and the Jetta Sportswagen. The Mercedes SUV series of ML320, GL320, and R320. This is the Blue Tech cars. Also, we're in the process of certifying two additional vehicles for BMW, the 3 Series sedan, and the BMW SUV. Now, for 2010 time frame, which means that the cars are going to be introduced in 2009, mm-hmm. next year. Honda Acura is going to be introduced in the marketplace based on what they're telling us. The Mercedes E320 Blue Tech sedan, the VW SUV, the Audi and Audi also SUV. So this is what I know about the potential diesel introductions in the light-duty sector.
Some states, however, have stricter emission standards than others, and those standards played a big part in keeping mm-hmm. diesel cars off the road in the United States. The cars that you just mentioned, will those diesel engines pass muster in all 50 states?
Yes. All these diesel cars that I mentioned will be a 50-state car.
giving them access, of course, to the coveted New York and California markets also.
Exactly, exactly. Also, if I may add, the U.S. manufacturers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler, also they are discussing clean diesel introductions. I just don't have the specifics.
Barbara, you're going to have to hold on to the second part of your question because we're going to have to take a short break. But if you hold, I'll try to get back to you as quickly as possible. If the lines are busy, you can send us an email to kojo@wamu.org with your questions or comments about diesel fuel. We're talking with Margot Ogay, Director of the Office of Transportation and Air Quality at the Environmental Protection Agency. It's Tech Tuesday. I'm Kojo Nandi.
On Tell Me More, we tell you more on matters ranging from personal finance.
I hope you're able to save more and spend more wisely.
To international affairs.
Although the issues in Zimbabwe are different to those in Kenya, people are worried that there may be violence.
To matters of faith.
The fundamentalists that I grew up with, they weren't interested in world domination. They just wanted to be left alone.
And of course, there's much more. So join us on Tell Me More from NPR News.
Today at 2 on WAMU 88.5.
This afternoon at 1 on WAMU's HD Channel 3. It's the BBC's World Have Your Say. This live, interactive program lets listeners participate in international conversations about current events. You can contact them for more information about getting your questions on the air at worldhaveyoursay.com. Click on Contact Us. That's World Have Your Say this afternoon at 1 on WAMU's HD Channel 3. Complete schedule information for HD Channel 3 is at wamu.org. Experiencing delays on the road? Call the WAMU traffic tip line at 202-885-8855. You can even view your route on the computer before leaving home. More information is at WAMU.org.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the Washington Performing Arts Society, presenting Andra Schiff in a program of Beethoven piano sonatas October 10th at 8 at the Music Center at Strathmore. Tickets and season schedule at WPAS.org or 202-785-WPAS.
It's a Tech Tuesday conversation on diesel with Margot Ogay, Director of the Office of Transportation and Air Quality at the Environmental Protection Agency. This email we got from Lewis in Arlington. We rented a Renault Scenic Diesel 6-speed small family wagon in Europe this summer and loved it. It was peppy, quiet, and very efficient. I think we got the equivalent of 45 miles per gallon, and it cruised silently on the big highways at 90 miles per hour, and there was no smoke, no noise. They've really gotten these diesels right over there. Wish I could buy this car here. Well, I guess we'll be hearing that sentiment from quite a few more people. Renewable fuels are all the rage these days, and one of the buzzwords that gets kicked around all the time is biodiesel. How is this related at all to traditional diesel fuel?
Okay. Biodiesel. Actually, the biofuel market is pretty big these days. If you go back last December, Congress and the President signed a new piece of legislation that has to do with energy issues. And part of it was to improve the fuel economy standards for cars, for new cars, but also to mandate 36 billion gallons of renewable fuels in the marketplace by 2022. That's about 15% displacement of gasoline. And as part of that, it's also a requirement to have about 1.5 billion gallons of biodiesel. Biodiesel basically today is used about 5% as a, you know, it's added to diesel, so it displaces 5% of diesel fuel. And today there are two feedstocks, two sources. One is waste, and the other one is soybean oil. So 5% is, we believe it's pretty safe. Some companies are suggesting to go as much as 10% or 20%. We need to be careful to make sure that these engines in the marketplace, especially the more advanced clean diesel engines, can deal with
I was about to ask, what would I have to do to get my car to run on biodiesel?
You have to buy a diesel. If you buy a diesel car...
make no adjustments whatsoever.
Make no adjustments whatsoever. If there are stations that they sell 5% diesel, like most of your gas stations here, they sell 10% ethanol in your gasoline. If it's up to 5% biodiesel, then we're pretty certain nothing's going to happen to your car. But I don't think you should go into the market and make your own diesel. And there are places, especially in the Midwest, where you can buy biodiesel fuel.
Allow me to go to Lee in Beelsville, Maryland. Lee, your turn.
Thank you very much, Kojo. I'd like to put a plug in for plug-in hybrid diesels and ask your guest about the availability. The reason is I've got a Prius that's going to turn into a plug-in this weekend, and I have solar panels on my house. So it's going to be basically a solar-powered vehicle that's going to get over 100 miles per gallon gasoline and cost me just a few dollars a week. And if you could combine a plug-in diesel hybrid with solar panels and locally made biodiesel, you've got just an incredibly wonderful package. Could you comment?
Certainly sounds like it.
Well, first of all, let me say congratulations to you for doing this. As you probably know, we cannot go to the market today and buy a plug-in hybrid. There are two companies that are working on plug-in hybrids. Other than the listener that has retrofitted his own vehicle for a plug-in hybrid, one is GM. GM is working on a vehicle that's called the Volt, able to go 40 miles just on electricity, on the electric motor. Doesn't use gasoline at all. And it has a small gasoline engine. I think it's like 1.4 liters that is used to recharge the battery. And also when you run out of, after 40 miles, obviously you can go to the gasoline engine. And we are very excited about the potential of that vehicle. GM is talking about 2010 introduction. And then you have Toyota that has announced a plug-in hybrid for the Prius, which can take you up to 10 miles on electric power, on the electric motor, and then obviously the gasoline kicks in. So both of them are wonderful introductions in the marketplace.
I have a Toyota Highlander hybrid. Why are they not doing a plug-in for the Highlander also?
You're going to have to ask them.
No, I'm asking you. Lee, thank you very much.
Let me tell you, one of the big challenges for a plug-in hybrid is that they're looking to go to lithium-ion batteries, which you're going to need for a plug-in hybrid, and there's still developmental work that is going on.
Well, thank you very much. Here is Chris in Woodbine, Maryland. Chris, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, Kojo. And trading off of what the last caller said and your Toyota hybrid, something about hybrids has been bothering me. I was just following a Prius, and when you look at it, it's an extremely light, aerodynamic, little jelly bean of a car. And I wonder if you took out all of that adaptive braking and that wonderful technology and simply put in a really efficient turbo diesel engine, wouldn't you get a very efficient car? In other words, your Highlander, how much better is that than a regular Highlander? And comparing that to the ecological problems of producing those batteries that it uses.
I'll have my representative answer that question. Margot Ogay?
Actually, very good question. Let me talk a little bit about diesel. So a diesel, on an average, could be anywhere from 25% to 40% better on fuel economy. A hybrid, let's assume we're talking about a full hybrid, anywhere from 30 to 50%. But also, before you make a decision to go to clean diesel or a hybrid, you have to think carefully your commute. If you drive in the city, stop and go, clearly consider a hybrid because you will do better. But if you drive rural highway, clearly diesel will do much better. So
I'm stop and go in the city, Chris. But thank you. Thank you very much for your call. Allow me to go to Liam in Sterling, Virginia. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
I'd like to just make a comment on the clean diesel and the VW Jetta TDI.
Sure.
I'm actually a racer of them. I'm 16 years old. And inside the R-Series, we, you know, obviously racing a car, you don't get very good fuel mileage and stuff. You get, you know, usually with, you know, 3 or 4 miles a gallon. But with this clean diesel, we get, you know, 25 miles a gallon on the racetrack, which is... doesn't sound like much, but it's a huge difference. And, you know, I know that if I took this car out on the street and just drove it in normal conditions, that it would get about 60 miles a gallon. And, you know, I really feel like that diesel is the future and the way to go, you know, at least until we can perfect all these other technologies that are out there. But, you know, it's I feel like it's a resource that remains very untapped in America. And in Europe, I mean, it's so popular. So, I mean, I'm just curious as to why we haven't gone to it earlier. I mean, it's cleaner, well, and it seems to, you know, get much better mileage, and it makes more sense for the public to be using.
Well, you heard Margot Ogay, or you may not talk earlier about the kind of regulatory requirements that make it different here in the United States than it is in Europe. I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Yeah, but basically, 50% of the population in this country breathes unhealthy air. Your existing diesel engines pollute as much as 10 times more than gasoline engines. And this pollution affects people. I mean, let me tell you, the diesel regulatory programs that we put in place for cleaner diesel cars, cleaner diesel trucks, cleaner diesel buses, farming and construction equipment, when these programs are implemented, based on the scientific analysis, we will be preventing 25,000 premature deaths in the United States. Millions and millions of asthma cases, respiratory cases, that will not happen. So I just want to make it clear that the old diesel was a very bad actor for the environment and public health. So there is a lot of future, a lot of hope, and I'm actually pretty excited about the clean diesel engines that we're seeing being introduced in the United States. Clean diesel cars will help us both to keep our air clean, but also will address the issue of energy security and climate change. So we are all for clean diesel, for hybrid engines, for plug-in hybrids, and all these other great technologies that are great for the country.
Let's go to Al in Arlington, Virginia. Al, go ahead, please.
Hello. Yes, you were all talking about hybrids and maybe having diesels be hybrids. And I'm a bit of a buff on this, and I enjoy reading about it. But the problem you have when you want to try to convert a diesel car to a hybrid is the fact that diesels need to run longer, and they wouldn't be able to do the stopping and starting that a hybrid car does. So when you stop at a stoplight with a hybrid car, the engine will turn off.
Yep.
And the diesel car would have problems from that. The technology is just not compatible.
I'm an engineer, but I would not even try to answer this question. What I can tell you, though, is that there are two companies in Europe that are in the process of working on diesel hybrids, and they will introduce them in the marketplace. One of them is Mercedes. They made an announcement at the European Auto Show last year, and the other one, I think, is, I believe, Renault. This is a company that's not bringing cars in this country. But again, let me just, if I can put one more plug on clean diesel and hybrid diesels. Just think of this. If, let's assume in the next 10, 20 years time frame, 50% of our cars are diesels, the same as Europe. So we drive the same miles a year with diesel as the Europeans do. It would be equivalent of saving about 1.5 billion million gallons of barrels of fuel, which is what we import from Saudi Arabia.
1.5 million barrels a day of oil. Is what we would be saving if 50% of us are driving diesel cars.
Yeah. Now, if it was hybrid, it would be equivalent to what we bring from the OPEC countries.
Altogether,
a hybrid diesel. Now, you would have similar kind of results if you were driving hybrids, if 50% of our vehicles were hybrids.
That's how much we would be saving.
A lot.
On to Dan in Washington, D.C. Dan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to comment on one of your earlier callers was asking about why diesels were so much more expensive and why Volkswagen was one of the only companies that had them. And I recently purchased a new car last year and did a lot of research on the subject. And part of the reason is the longevity of diesels is better than both gasoline and the hybrids. Plus, it's a proven technology that, you know, the hybrids have only been around for 10 years or so at the most, whereas diesels have been around for years and years, and all they're doing is just cleaning them up.
Okay, seems to be a good point. Thank you for making it, Dan.
Yep.
It seems that a lot of foreign automakers, listening to the list you're reading, are leading the push for new diesel designs. Are American companies getting behind this as well?
Yes, because clearly all our domestic companies, GM, Ford, and Chrysler, are thinking of introducing diesel, starting with SUVs and pickup trucks.
Thinking of? When does thinking become action in our auto industry? For a lot of us, diesel means big. It triggers thoughts of pickup trucks and vans, SUVs. Are any of our auto manufacturers looking into diesel designs for smaller cars?
The only company that I'm aware of is GM, has made an announcement that by 2011, which means 2010 time frame, will be introducing a passenger car. They're also talking about light-duty trucks in 2011. I believe Ford is talking about a light-duty truck in 2011, and Chrysler, a light-duty truck in 2011. That's what I know of. Clearly, these companies probably have other plans that I'm not aware of.
Back to the telephones. Here is Balu in White Marsh, Maryland. Balu, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo.
Hi, Balu.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask a question. It's more regulatory in nature. I've had the opportunity to live in a number of outside countries, such as Jamaica, India, visited a number of countries in Europe, and had the fortune of driving diesel cars 10, 15 years ago. They were not the greatest of diesel cars. They were not the clean engine diesel. Yet, at the same time, they returned the owner of those vehicles well over 40 to 50% in savings due to the combined cost of fuel and mileage. I know this is not something new, but I struggle with the fact that the cost of making diesel versus the cost of making gasoline, if we forget about all the regulatory controls, is supposedly far cheaper because crude oil or petroleum is actually refined through a process called cracking. And the diesel is extracted a lot cheaper than gasoline. So from the perspective of Exxon or Shell, they're spending far less money extracting this diesel from petroleum.
Well, I'm not an engineer, even though I sometimes play one on the radio, so speak with a real engineer.
But again, what I said earlier is that the refineries have a specific ratio. They have constructed the refinery plants based on a specific ratio of how much diesel they will produce, how much gasoline they will produce. And today they're producing more gasoline than diesel. So it's an issue of supply-demand. They can make adjustments to that ratio. It does take time, it does take money, and if the market demands for more diesel, they will make those decisions. I cannot talk about ExxonMobil or any other oil company.
That depends on American consumer preference. And how that is expressed. Margo Ogay is the director of the Office of Transportation and Air Quality at the Environmental Protection Agency. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo. Thank you so much.
We're going to be taking a short break. When we come back, Internet radio performance royalty fees and what Congress is doing about it. I'm Kojo Namdi. Hey Every day, the Kojo Namdi Show explores important issues hitting home in your neighborhood, your region, and your world. It's your opportunity to speak out or just to listen, hear new voices, and share new views. Every day, noon till 2, on the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5 FM.
On Tell Me More, we tell you more on matters ranging from personal finance.
I hope you're able to save more and spend more wisely.
To international affairs.
Although the issues in Zimbabwe are different to those in Kenya, people are worried that there may be violence.
To matters of faith.
The fundamentalists that I grew up with, they weren't interested in world domination. They just wanted to be left alone.
And of course, there's much more. So join us on Tell Me More from NPR News.
Today at 2 on WAMU 88.5.
This week, WAMU's Bluegrass Country is broadcasting live from Nashville at IBMA World of Bluegrass. We'll be kicking our broadcast off at 1 with a review of last night's keynote address. That's on WAMU's Bluegrass Country or bluegrasscountry.org.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Hodgson Consulting, an Ektron Gold partner, providing content management solutions for clients' web-based initiatives. Hodgson Consulting, fueled by technology, powered by people, on the web at HodgsonConsult.com.
Tonight on Marketplace, the financial events on Wall Street, a ripple effect across the globe. That's on Marketplace tonight at 6. Let's return to the conversation on the Kojo Namdi Show.
This week, we saw a great example of bipartisan cooperation on Capitol Hill. No, really, I'm serious. You could even call it a kind of financial bailout, but of course, it wasn't that financial bailout. For the past several years, a copyright royalty fight was threatening to silence all internet radio stations, from big guns like CBS to small players like AccuRadio.com. These last few weeks found industry insiders speculating about internet radio being on the verge of extinction. But this week, individual representatives on Capitol Hill heard directly from some of their constituents, the 54 million people who log on and listen to internet radio, people who love their reggae, their country western, or their polka, the people who would be most directly affected by the loss of internet radio. We find out what happened, how it may affect your pocketbook and your listening habits in the future. Joining us in studio is Skip Peasy, contributing editor to Radio World magazine. He's also the former senior technical policy manager for Microsoft's Entertainment and Devices division. Skip Peasy, thank you for joining us.
Good to be back, Kojo.
Just over a year ago, Skip, in May of 2007, the Copyright Royalty Board issued its controversial decision requiring internet broadcasters to pay royalties on the music they played. Take us back a bit and give us the thinking behind that decision and what resulted from it.
Well, the high level of all this is that it's actually pretty exciting when you think about it. It shows that the creative arts and even the creative technology in delivering those arts is still moving forward. It's still dynamic, and so much so that it's taken the lawmakers and our economic systems a tough time to try to keep up with it. So, you know, from one side of the, that's
it's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a good thing. But then getting down into trying to make a living in that business, it's truly the Chinese curse of living an interesting time. Certainly the music business has been, it's been very interesting for them for the last few years. So the world works a different way in this country. And we have what we call statutory royalties. That is that the government sets a royalty rate that broadcasters will pay to either songwriters or musicians and performers for the right of broadcasters to play that music on their airwaves or other distribution methods. And because there are new methods, such as satellite radio and internet radio in the last few years, the new rules, laws, basically, rates have had to be set. And the Copyright Office has been the party that sets these rates. And they came up with a first set around 2000 for internet radio. And then they said, because it's a new thing, we'll look at it every 5 years or so and reset for another five-year period. And that last reset was the one you were just talking about. And it was a big change from the previous rate schedule. It also was a different process that they went through. They're really sort of making up the rules as they go along. They sort of have to as a result of this very dynamic environment. And the new rates with a sliding scale upwards for the next few years, made it look to internet radio providers that it would put them out of business. It was just a very onerous amount of payment, and nobody really thought that it was fair on the internet radio side. Of course, the music industry felt like it was definitely a fair way to go. So there was lots of controversy, and bringing us up to the present time, they're still trying to sort out a fair and equitable arrangement for all players.
What's the difference between what commercial radio broadcasters pay in performance royalty fees and what internet radio was being asked to pay?
Well, it's very different, in fact. Remember, commercial broadcast radio or broadcast radio in general came up at a very different time. And in those days, the only legacy they had was from sheet music royalties, which were paid to composers. So broadcast radio does pay composers of songs a small royalty for the right to play their songs. The recordings, however, came along later, and by that time, broadcast radio had been established as a real important way of promoting the sale of records. And so the music industry thought, well, this is a quid pro quo here. We sell records by getting them played on the air. We don't need pennies from royalties. We'll make dollars from the sale of the records that the radio stations play, so everybody wins. And that's been the legacy there that broadcast radio has enjoyed in not having to pay any performance royalties, that is, royalties to the people who play on the records and to the owners of the actual recordings. The songwriting is a separate issue. Internet radio and satellite radio came along later, and by that time, the record industry was feeling the pinch of reduced sales and looking at every possible way they could collect more revenues, and because they were digital, they were different. So they could use that kind of distinction to say we need new royalties, and in this case, from day one, we're going to start charging royalties for the actual recordings, so that the musicians and the labels who own and who publish those recordings will get a piece of that action. And so satellite radio has been paying millions of dollars a year on that basis. They also pay the composer royalties, too, that everybody pays. And internet radio has been paying them as well. They just use these three various modes, though. Not only do they have different rules, the way they are now calculating these royalties are very different for internet radio. Because internet radio doesn't make a lot of money, it's not a simple thing as saying, well, just give us a certain percentage of your revenues. So that's where this very complex and scary to internet broadcasters method of calculating royalties came about, and that's what all the argument has been about in the last since they've set these new rates and what they're trying to settle right now.
Skip Pizzi is a contributing editor to Radio World magazine, and for this broadcast, a demystifier of the performance royalties that are paid by internet radio, and we really thank you for doing that because it is indeed very complicated. The small webcasters, you pointed out that internet radio doesn't make that much money. The small webcaster said the royalties would drive them out of business, amounting to, in some cases, 75% of their businesses, and in other cases, at the other extreme, 200% of their businesses. Mm-hmm. Would it really have cost them that much?
I think there was a little bit of saber rattling going on, but by and large, there was a serious threat, a legitimate threat to the to the continued existence of this very broad and sort of democratic form of broadcasting that we've seen come up in the internet radio world. And I don't think anybody would benefit from that, either musicians or the public. So I think it behooves everybody that's involved here to come up with something that sets up a fair arrangement so that musicians get adequately compensated, and also that internet radio can continue to flourish, because it's, I think, a really important part of the American, a fledgling, but growing importance to the American cultural scene.
Some point to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act as the problem. They say a new standard in that law resulted in, and here we're going to ask you to demystify again, resulted in the willing buyer, willing seller rule.
What's that about?
Well, that's the fancy name they give to that complex method of calculation of those royalties that I referred to earlier, as opposed to just a percentage of revenue, as a tip, which is the typical way you calculate a royalty. How much you making? Okay, give me a piece of it. And that works in satellite radio, and it works in broadcast radio for the composer royalties that they pay. And it might work in the future. This is another subject we may get to, because the music industry wants to see if maybe they can start getting performance royalties from the over-the-air broadcasters as well. But that's a separate discussion.
That's one for the future.
That's absolutely right. And that's why broadcasters, over-the-air broadcasters, have had a tough time here trying to figure out how they want to come down on this discussion.
Do we want to maintain our advantage over internet and satellite radio, or do we realize that soon they'll be coming after us?
Well, or that it's part of your future as well. Broadcasters
sure.
have the opportunity to make to be on the internet, as you are now, and many stations are. Yeah. And so is that our future as broadcasters? That's what they're thinking? Or is this just an ancillary business? And in fact, is it more competitive than it is advantageous to us? But the willing buyer, willing seller, by the way, just is an economic term, economics with a capital E, that determines how to come up with what the Copyright Royalty Board, who is the new, somewhat new group that sets this, a three-judge panel part of the Copyright yep. Office, that it sets these rates up, and they use this term from economics to try to come up with something that seemed like a fair rate when there wasn't the option of just using a percentage of gross revenues, because most of these internet radios, or many of them anyway, are essentially just marginal operations.
Copyright Royalty Board is a panel of three attorneys called judges who are experts in the field and convene under the seal of the Library of Congress. They set the rates for how much satellite companies, radio stations, and others will pay to use multiple copyrighted work so that the broadcasters or webcasters don't have to get separate licenses from each copyright owner. The accord reached this weekend doesn't actually resolve the royalty mm-hmm. issue, so what does it do?
Well, talk about inside baseball. What this new draft law, it hasn't been passed yet even, would allow to happen is that webcasters could make arrangements with an entity called Sound Exchange, which really was established initially by the Copyright Office purely as a collections agency. It's a mechanism, basically, that would take these royalties and then disperse them to the appropriate parties, which include the record labels and the individual musicians. It's a very kind of complex process, even, to find these musicians and get that money out to them. So that was Sound Exchange's job. Somehow along the line, Sound Exchange, because it was really sitting there with all these funds, morphed its way into being a negotiating body in this ongoing argument that's been happening since the Copyright Royalty Board's last ruling on rates. And now what this new law will allow is it actually codifies the ability for Sound Exchange to do that, because they really weren't supposed to be a negotiating body. They just kind of filled in the, for lack of any other common group and or representative body. So now Sound Exchange is empowered, or would be empowered by this law if it were passed, to make these negotiations on behalf of its members, which are the labels, the major labels, and many musicians, as well as non-members. In other words, Sound Exchange is now empowered to negotiate for the entire music business, basically, or anybody who would receive royalties from the internet radio community.
And Sound Exchange says that the main problem it sees is that very few internet radio stations or radio firms actually have good business models. Are they right?
Well, I mean, it is a fledgling industry, as we said. I mean, you could have said that about radio stations back in, the 1930s. So you got to crawl before you can walk. And there are, I would say, most internet radio services are of that model. And that's one of the great things about it, is that, somebody from their basement can start putting out stuff and people can listen to it and maybe enjoy it. That doesn't mean it can be monetized, and that's the problem. And Sound Exchange says, well, look, The only reason people are listening is because you're playing our stuff. The musicians are sort of in loco parentis for the whole community now. They're saying it's our content that's drawing your listeners. But many of these stations are not, internet radio services are not commercial. They are making, if they stay afloat at all, it's by contributions. And of course, public radio knows how that works and knows that it can work actually fairly well, at least to pay the bills. And in other cases, there are commercials either on the visual screen that the user looks at when they're going to the site, or in fact, in some cases, in the audio streams. And there are a huge range of entities that provide internet radio service, as you said, from some very large ones to some very small ones, and including regular radio stations who can, and radio groups who are just as able to be, and perhaps more able in many cases, to be good internet radio broadcasters as anybody else in that environment.
I understand the action now moves to the Senate. We only have about 30 seconds left. Got a prediction about what will happen there?
Well, no, actually. I think it's anybody's guess. I also think beyond the passage of a law, if it were to happen, there might be court challenges. This is, I don't think, the most robust way to go about it, but at least maybe it can work, and hopefully it'll come up with something that's fair to everybody involved.
Skip Peasy is a contributing editor to Radio World Magazine. He's also the former senior technical policy manager for Microsoft's Entertainment and Devices Division. Thank you very much for demystifying.
My pleasure. I hope it helped.
It certainly helped me, and I'm sure it helped our listeners. And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Coming up next hour, it's your turn to sound off on the bailout flameout. Whether you want to offer your solution, point the finger at a deserving member of Congress, or speculate about how this will all play out on the campaign trail, you can call us at 800-433-8850, or you can send email to us at kojo@wamu.org. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Nnamdi Show, a takeout tour from China to El Salvador. A local food writer explains why the path to the international culinary cutting edge leads to the suburbs. Plus, a people's history of sport, American athletes who wore their politics on their sleeves and spoke out on apartheid and human rights. The Kojo Nnamdi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5.
Members of the Armed Forces and Civil Service employees can support the program.